energy and hope to people celebrating the event to observe Iranian traditions and enter the new year with a totally fresh spirit. The arrival of Nowruz for Iranians is tantamount to shopping spree and finishing their undone work. Millions of Iranians embrace the turn of the Persian year and celebrate the spring festival with many ceremonial customs waiting to be observed.
Well, everybody is busy shopping. It is time of Nowruz and the new year. I have bought sabze, sweets and fruits. We're waiting for the new year to arrive.
Sofre Hafsin is unique, symbolic for the Nowruz festivity and its tradition. The Hafsin spread includes 7 items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there's a history behind each element, including serke, vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, sumac represents love and compassion, sib, apple, is a symbol of health and fertility, senjit, silverberry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection. Sabze, sprouts, symbolizes rebirth. Seed or garlic is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction. And samanu represents affluence.
This year it's different, as it has coincided with Ramadan. So we visit our family members and parents after iftar. And yes, it is great.
Nowruz is a unique opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz is regarded as a cultural bridge which unites people. This year, as Nowruz holidays coincide with the holy month of Ramadan, family members will most likely meet up after sunset or time of iftar when those who are fasting break their fast. Nowruz has begun and the Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity to mark the first day of spring and the renewal of life and nature. This year, Nowruz has a different flavor to it as the Iranians are celebrating it with the holy month of Ramadan together, making it an exception. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Earlier this month, the Maidenhead constituency in southeast England woke up to the resignation of its Conservative MP of 27 years, former Prime Minister Theresa May. Hers was one of up to 100 other well-established as well as younger MPs across the political parties announcing they wouldn't be running in the yet-to-be-announced next general election. Scottish Nationalist Party member Martin Day explains why so many are choosing to go.
For some, it's just age. They've reached retirement age and they're going. For others, they've got family commitments and they want to do that or other things with their lives. But for some, it's the toxic nature of politics. It's the toxic nature on social media where they're being trolled. And for some, they're actually being physically stalked and threatened with violence.
One MP, Caroline Lucas, the Parliament's only Green MP of 14 years, has cited the dysfunctionality of Parliament as her reason.
This Parliament has always been dysfunctional. I think perhaps one of the benefits of social media and modern television is that we see it more. It's not fit for this 21st century. I don't think it was fit for the 20th century. It's a Victorian construct, and it worked in their day. It doesn't work in our day. We should have electronic voting, we should have proportional representation systems, and we shouldn't have an unelected second chamber.
But while resignations are not uncommon ahead of a general election, it is different this time round. At least as far as the ruling Tories are concerned.
Well, you've heard the phrase, rats deserting a sinking ship. Clearly, the Tory ship is sinking, and that's why so many of them are jumping overboard and seeking refuge elsewhere.
Britons will vote in local elections in May. The Tories are 26 points behind the opposition Labour Party in opinion polls. Pressure is growing on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to call an early national vote.
As it stands, there won't be a general election in May, but one in the second half of the year seems more likely. Nevertheless, catastrophic results in the upcoming local elections could mean that Rishi Sunak and his Conservative Party's days in power are numbered. Saipur is up, London.
South Korea this week hosts the third U.S. initiative of the Summit for Democracy. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken suggested America could lead the world toward democratic ideals lacking elsewhere.
Vitalizing democracy will also require us to shape a technological future that's inclusive, that's rights-respecting, directed at driving progress in people's lives. as authoritarian and repressive regimes deploy technologies to undermine democracy and human rights, we need to ensure that technology sustains and supports democratic values and norms.
Corralled away from the venue, activists were joined by a South Korean lawmaker to question Washington's and Seoul's credibility, particularly in light of U.S. support of Israel's ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza.
Since Yoon Suk-yeol came into power, our democracy index has fallen by 19 points, and we're turning into a very backward country in terms of democracy. The United States, the enabler of the massacre, Israel, the perpetrator of the massacre, and South Korea are causing the endless decline of democracy.
Activists say the U.S. and South Korea have the blood of tens of thousands of innocents on their hands through the provision of weapons to Israel and failure to pressure Tel Aviv to end its genocide.
It's not the time for the South Korean government or the U.S. government, who are complicit in Israel's genocide, to discuss democracy. Instead, the Korean government should urge the U.S. and Israel to immediately stop the genocide, lift the blockade of the Gaza Strip, and end Israel's colonial military occupation of Palestine.
While a rift has appeared in U.S. support of Israel, concern is mounting that the Israeli military will increase attacks on the already besieged Rafah, where Palestinians await humanitarian aid amid reports of starvation. Like here, around the world can be found supporters of a free Palestine protesting against Israel's genocide in Gaza week after week. And here at this summit titled Democracy for Future Generations, a glaring question clouds proceedings. What will happen to the next generation of Palestinians? Frank Smith, Seoul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances can deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government. Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian National Initiative said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership.
We're not against the new government. We're against the way the government is being formed. We want a national consensus government, a government which is acceptable and accepted by all Palestinian political groups through a national dialogue between the different groups. And that is natural because, and for us, the main goal first before forming a government is how we structure a unified Palestinian national leadership.
Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyi, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on the Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption. A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges, namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
On Saturday, thousands of people joined a new rally in the Italian capital, organized, among the others, by the movement of the Palestinian students and the Association of the Palestinians in Italy. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide, also saw the participation of high school students and families. People at the rally strongly condemned Italy's unwavering support to the Israeli regime.
Italy, that claims to be a democratic nation, is a country where the government goes against the people's will. Profits always come first, even when a genocide is taking place. I'm teaching my kids to never give up the fight and to never accept being submitted.
The Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto has recently said that Rome has continued to export arms to Israel despite assurances last year that the government was blocking such sales following Tel Aviv's invasion of the Gaza Strip. Some Italian media reports recently revealed that despite the Italian government's denials, the value of arms sales to Israel more than tripled in December 2023 compared with the same month in 2022. And December last year was the peak of Israeli bombardments on the Gaza Strip.
Western governments have been systematically supporting Zionism and Israel's criminal regime, notwithstanding the protest against Israel's crimes that have been taking place across the globe. Italy's support to Tel Aviv must stop once and for all.
La soluzione sarebbe... A solution to the onslaught in Gaza could be found if the international community stopped militarily supporting Israel. Italy, on its side, has been actively arming Israel through companies such as Leonardo and others. If we don't make sure that the Palestinians' right to self-determination is protected, and nothing will ever change.
Earlier this week, more protests and initiatives in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians were held in several Italian cities, including Milan and Naples. Max Civili, Rome.
A growing strategic partnership between Azerbaijan and Iran in the energy sector on full display. A collaboration that promises to bolster economic development and energy security beyond the borders of the two countries and in the region, as described by the Iranian Minister of Energy and his visiting Azerbaijani counterpart. A highlight of this cooperation is the near completion of hydroelectric power plants on the Aras River, a vital waterway on the Iran-Azerbaijan border, with construction progress reported at 96%. The strategic importance of these hydroelectric projects extends beyond national benefits, signaling a move towards greater energy independence and regional cooperation, including the creation of an energy bridge linking Azerbaijan, Iran, and Russia by connecting Iran and Russia's power grids through the Republic of Azerbaijan. This follows decisions made 2 weeks ago during the 17th Iran-Russia Joint Economic Commission in Tehran to boost economic relations in different fields. Managing shared water resources for energy production lays the groundwork for more mutually beneficial cooperation, which is why the presidents of both countries will be attending the inaugural ceremony.
The projects are in the final stages, promising a significant boost in Iran-Azerbaijan bilateral relations, all in line with President Ebrahim Raisi's policy to expand relations with neighboring countries. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The top annual analysis of global arms sales found that France has risen to the number two weapons exporter in the world. The gains have often been made thanks to debt from Ukraine, which has become Europe's largest arms importer. French arms sales have soared 50% in recent years and now comprise 11% of the global market. The world's leading arms dealer is still the United States, which controls a record 42% of the global weapons trade. Arms sales to Ukraine has proven to be big business, and it may explain President Emmanuel Macron's about-face on the conflict. 2 years ago, Macron warned that Russia must not be humiliated, but he's recently become one of Europe's leading anti-Russia war hawks. France's top three arms clients are India, which is the world's largest arms importer, followed by Saudi Arabia and tiny but rich Qatar. Africa is still reeling from 40 tons of illegal free arms drops France made in 2011 to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. As predicted, the weapons soon found their way to Syria, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, and elsewhere. This week, French Parliament approved a 10-year military pact with Kiev, which guarantees billions in more weapons deliveries. Russia continues to gain ground against NATO-backed Ukraine, which is an important reminder that some weapons are made to work under actual wartime conditions, and some are made mainly for sales and profit. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles De Verre, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting, as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles de Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape. A very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach. Lawyers believe that we live in a new era in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisun Shahmadi, Tehran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Hazrat Khadija's value has not been properly appreciated. This is the part of the speech delivered on May 9, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with officials of the Hazrat Khadija Commemoration Congress. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. First of all, I am very grateful to you gentlemen for thinking of carrying out such an endeavor and for pursuing it in a motivated manner. Hazrat Khadija, God's greetings be upon her, is a really unrecognized personality. The fact that she was honored with being the spouse of the Holy Prophet is more valuable in her case. Others were honored with being his spouses as well, but they did not endure the sufferings that the Holy Prophet did during the time when he became the Prophet. After that era, he was in Medina for 10 years. Well, in that era, he had the respect of others, and life was relatively easier. Hazrat Khadija, God's greetings be upon her, endured those sufferings in the first era alongside the Holy Prophet.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
First of all, the very essence of believing in the Holy Prophet, the first people who believed in him were the Commander of the Faithful and Hazrat Khadija, is a great privilege. It has extra value. Banding the beliefs which one has lived with for so long is not easy. This has not occurred to us so that we can understand how difficult and important it is. With her pure nature, she immediately understood the truth of the matter and the Holy Prophet's legitimacy. As soon as she saw the Holy Prophet in that state of mind, in that well-known spiritual state which has been mentioned in books, while he had just recently returned from Hira, she realized that something important had happened, and thus her heart was attracted to him and she began to believe in him. Later on, she stood by her faith. You mentioned that she dedicated her wealth to his cause. Well, this is easy to say. Those who have money can afford to dedicate it to a cause, but if someone completely abandons her life of comfort, in other words, if someone lets go of all their money and dedicates all their wealth to a certain cause, this is not about some bits and pieces here and there. It is said about Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, God's greetings be upon him, that he gave up his entire possessions or half of his belongings several times over his lifetime. This is among the greatest privileges.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in his New Year address, congratulated the Iranian nation on the occasion of Nowruz, renewing emphasis on productivity and the people's participation in enhancing productivity. He noted how the enemy has failed in pursuing a policy to economically defeat the Iranian nation, just like how it will fail when it comes to the issue of Palestine and the genocidal war that the U.S. and Israel are pursuing. In this edition of the program, we will break down the speech by Iran's leader and look at some of the different ways that Iran's enemies have failed in trying to break the will of the Islamic Republic. First, let me introduce our guest. Masoud Shajara, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. Welcome to you both. I'd like to start with you, Master Shajara, and Happy Nowruz, by the way. Let's look at the slogan that the Iran's leader has introduced, and that is Year of Surge in Production through People's Participation. And let me get a reaction from you on that.
First of all, I'd like to wish you a Happy New Rules. But the fact of the matter is that every beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the West and was totally committed to undermine and indeed bring a regime change. And I remember it very, very, very clearly that year by year, month by month, they were saying that the Islamic Revolution is not going to last any more than a month, more than a year. And this went on and on and on. And now the Islamic Revolution is so established that that is unbelievable. Despite all the efforts that has been made, all the sanction, all the sort of political maneuvering, financial restrictions, and on and on and on, Iran is going from strength to strength. It's Iran at the time of revolution, and indeed just after revolution, was not able to get enough barbed wire to defend itself against Saddam Hussein and all who were helping Saddam Hussein. Let's not forget it was the West, it was the East, it was the sort of all the neighbors, Arab nations, and so forth and so on. Despite all that, Iran has survived and has gone from strength to strength. Now Iran is actually a military power. Iran has shown that sanctions is not going to affect it. It will, and it has put pressure, but Iran is going from strength to strength. And the speech of Ayatollah Khamenei today was actually highlighting that and actually saying that we need to build up on that. And the way that needs to be done, the way to do it, is through the empowerment of people. It needs to come by the people, for the people, and there's no other way for it. And we need to mobilize the empowerment of the ordinary Iranians right across the nation to go even further than what they have done already.
Indeed. Well, the speech that was made today from Mohsen Abbas was pretty forthright. And Iran's leader actually not only talked about Iran's strengths, as our guests there mentioned, but also about Iran's challenges when it comes to what it has to do. And one of the ones obviously has been this economic challenge, of which we will get into the pressure from the West, i.e. the U.S. in particular. But he said the key to solving the economic problems are domestic and national production, but with the participation of the people. Tell us what your take is on that, in particular the fact that he has somewhat underlined people's participation in its slogan overall.
Well, I think what the technical term for this is the growing strength of a resistance economy, because that's what the Islamic Republic of Iran has opted for. It's elected for that, but it's also been rather forced into that, because the kind of sanctions that Iran has been terrorized with over the years have just grown exponentially, and they're at a level which is almost inconceivable, especially for the nation in the condition it was from 79, the condition that Shah had left it in, and then of course all the constant psychological operations, the constant cultural revolutionary operations that the West has been engaged in, the military operations, an 8-year war imposed on the nation, and that has to be taken into account. All of this trillion-dollar effort to bring down Iran has failed. I mean, if you were just to look at the American investment in the media soft power exercise in trying to brainwash or indoctrinate Iranians living in Iran about how bad their government is, well, you'd be shocked, because there are hundreds and hundreds of these media agents which are backed, and journalists, etc. And it's that soft power war, which actually Ayatollah Khamenei has hinted at, far more dangerous than any military threat that America now has against Iran, because that's been negated with the fantastic scientific and military development and the technological developments of the IRGC and all the other agencies that have been involved to get Iran up to speed in being able to defend itself. Well, we know that we can see in all the theaters that Iran has launched itself, it's been more than adequate in pushing back the Americans, in holding them down, and actually making them now think about leaving the region. It's the soft power which is far more dangerous, the cultural indoctrination, so the depletion of morale, trying to make the Iranian people think that they're failing. But you see, Ayatollah Khomeini said one thing. He said, no East, no West, that there is Islam at the heart of what you're going to do. And the Iranians really have to remember this fully and totally adopt it, because you know, this is the third way. There is the socialist systems have failed. The neoliberal West is struggling with its hyper-capitalist systems here as well. The only real option that gives poor, ordinary people a chance at having a real genuine government and a genuine movement, which is for the oppressed and for the downtrodden, it is the Velayat-e Faqih system of Iran. I have great belief in that. The question is really, will the rest of the people who have erstwhile been supporters of this recognize the power and the necessity and the absolute strength of this system? That, I think, is what Ayatollah Khamenei has been referring to when he talks about hope and faith being two primary factors driving Iran's national interests and the future. They've got to have both.
Indeed. Well, when we talk about Iran, Masoud Shajari, in terms of the pressure that comes from the West, in particular the U.S., we're talking about the economic pressure with the goal of, many understand that to be regime change, really, trying to make people discontent. And I think Iran obviously not only realizes that, but this 13th administration, headed by Raisi, is completely aware of that. And we can see that in its presence in different trade pacts that it has signed with different blocs, like the SCO, like being a member of the BRICS organization now. Iran's leader acknowledged that that is a good thing. At the same time, he said that we need those MOUs that have been signed to turn into action, basically. And that therein is, that's pretty significant for him to say that pretty much in one breath. Tell us what you think about that and how important that plays, the acknowledgement by Iran's leader on that issue, and that it needs to translate into action.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there are those who are saying that if there wasn't this Western opposition, these sanctions, these sort of Cold War and economical war against Iran, Iran would have been turned into a heaven. It would have flourished so much. I would say that, you know, actually some of these sanctions have forced Iran to become more independent. And in some ways, you know, when you look at, as I said, sort of beginning of the revolution, Iran couldn't even defend itself fully. Now it's being accused of being a power, not just in the region, but in Ukraine, and is helping Russia. So there are victories, there are empowerment, there are actually the fact that Iran is becoming a not just a regional power, but a world power. But I think in same time, we need to understand that we could have done much better. And indeed, the speech of Ayatollah Khamenei was focusing on that, that we are going the right direction, but we could do much better by the participation of masses. And I think this is really so true and so factual, that the only way forward is more people getting involved and realizing that unless masses will get fully engaged, we are not going to see the result that we desire. And this encouragement and this empowerment of the ordinary people, reliance on the ordinary people as a way of addressing all these issues in much better way than we have done in past, I think it was the main aspect of the message today.
Taking a look at the way that he described two of the highlights of this past year, he talked about the epic participation of the people in Quds Day, said Mohsen Abbas. He also talked about the 22nd of Bahman rallies, a couple of the highlights, which involved obviously masses of Iranians that came out in the millions. You know, when you see that, obviously there's support for the Islamic establishment to the fullest degree. But yet the U.S. and some Western countries are pushing for the disillusionment of Iranians. While they should be the one that should be disillusioned now when they see so many people coming out, why do they keep pursuing a policy, anti-Iranian policy then?
Because they know they're going to fail with hard power. They know there is no way that they can bring down the Islamic Republic's leadership, its government, its political purpose and direction, its system, without using that deadly soft power and the propaganda. You see, they have the most sophisticated dark arts when it comes to brainwashing people, indoctrinating them, in culturally almost preparing them. And Hollywood is part of this. You know, you look at Hollywood, you look at all those kind of media outputs that they give. All of it is geared towards othering Muslims, or it's geared towards demonizing Iran, creating Iranophobia subtly or very overtly. So on the one hand, you've got the cultural attack that's going on the Iranians. But of course, the hard news itself, if you listen just to the output of the likes of the BBC and others, they are viciously against Iran in every way, shape and form, and they are grooming their people to be that way, yet still not fully worked. I mean, it's difficult at the best of times for getting Western people to really take foreign policy seriously. You can see that with the kind of lethargy amongst many still around Gaza. Even a genocide doesn't motivate some people to literally take on these kind of heinous, suppressive, tyrannical governments. They're not democratic governments, and it's not a democratic system we have here. We have an oligarchy. In the background, this oligarchy has a huge apparatus, a machinery. It's dominated by Zionists. It has a hate campaign for Iran. It fears Iran because Iran offers the only viable alternative, which exposes their lies and their fake democracy. So Iran, with its religious democracy, spiritual democracy, call it what you like, with that system that exists in Iran, it poses an existential threat to the Western fake neoliberal pseudo-democracies here. And it's already showing the people in West Asia that actually there is a way to succeed, because Iran has, by its mere survival with the resistance economy and its advancements in economic self-sufficiency, with its advancements sure. in building up its industries, it's showing the rest of the Arab world, the Western Asia, that you don't have to be a puppet and a slave of American dollars in order to succeed as a nation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, the issue of double standards comes at play here. My question to you, Master Shadr, when we talk about the very sad issue of Palestine, I mean, it's really sad what is happening there. We all acknowledge that. Iran's leader on both occasions that he spoke today obviously referenced to the issue of Palestine and showed the double standards that the West plays, in particular the U.S. being complicit in this. When it comes to the issue of Palestine, he said that the U.S. and Israel are both stuck. They're in a quagmire now. Whether they pull out or whatever they do, they can't escape what has occurred. What's your impression of what he has said there?
Well, and I would go even further and say that, you know, it exposed the whole of institutions that have been set up under so-called liberal democracy. And to address the aspiration of the world community everybody now sees it, that not just United States and Europe and the Western so-called allies are failing in illusions that they have created, that they're standing for democracy, human rights, and justice, and supporting apartheid genocide. But also the institutions like UN and international courts are failing to address and try to do anything to stop this genocide taking place. You know, the action of the whole of the institutions have not even stopped the killing of one child up to today in the last few months. What has made a difference is the resistance which in Lebanon, in Yemen, and in Iraq and elsewhere, and resistance from Palestine itself, which everybody knows that the support of setting up such a axis of resistance, it goes back to a vision of Ayatollah Khamenei, and indeed the vision of knowing that nothing else is going to happen if communities will not stand up to stand against this genocide. Everyone around the world, be it they acknowledge or not, they are seeing that the only thing which is stopping or slowing down the genocidal act of Zionist state, which is being supported by U.S. and its allies, is the resistance. And who set up that resistance, who encouraged that resistance, who is sort of made sure plan for that resistance to be fit for purpose, is very clear. So that is very obvious now, and that the aspirations for justice, which is being sought by masses in Europe and elsewhere, ordinary people, cannot be addressed by these institutions, and is only being addressed by axes of resistance.
Yeah, these institutions have indeed failed when it comes to the issue of Palestine, but it's really telling, say, Mohsen Abbas, when you have the UN come out with this report, this so-called fact-finding mission, criticizing Iran for the handling of the riots that occurred on late 2022. And the Iranian foreign minister, a month ago almost, accusing the UN of double standards, criticizing it for basically setting up this fact-finding mission, but yet not taking any serious action when it comes to Israel's genocide and the killing of civilians in the Gaza Strip. That's a failure on the institution, isn't it?
Well, double standards, hypocrisy, lies, they're not just isolated within the political apparatus of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, nor are they just within the media. They exist also within these international institutions because they are an extension of that power. The funding that the UN gets from America, the funding that, for instance, the WHO gets from people like Bill Gates and the transnational corporations, which are also linked to these guys. You've got also the atomic agencies, which on the one hand will pressure Iran to try to admit that it has nuclear weapons or capacity when it doesn't. Yet with Israel, you'll see they'll completely ignore anything that they know perfectly well they have in terms of nuclear weapons. Everybody knows it's an open secret of 400 plus nuclear weapons that Israel has at its disposal. The way they dealt with Ukraine and the way the whole of the so-called international community, which usually is a euphemism basically for all the American allies, they all turned around and wanted all sorts of boycotting of Russia, etc., and the shutting down of everything. They haven't done any of that with Israel. Not one little thing has been done to harm Israel's connections diplomatically, politically, culturally, or otherwise. Yet you can see the hypocrisy when they come to Iran or Russia. So expect nothing from these institutions. They were created after the Second World War to serve the interests of the global elitists. They still serve those global elites, and the Anglo-Zionist Empire's boots on the ground in terms of the Israeli occupation, or whether it's the U.S. American military occupations of those regions, that's just their boots on the ground to carry out the orders. So Iran stands at the nexus of the resistance. They are not coordinating that resistance. The resistance does what it wants. Ayatollah Khamenei said it again today, that Hezbollah and the factions in Iraq and the the factions that exist in Yemen who are putting up the resistance have their own independent strategies and policies, but Iran supports them, and it makes no bones about that. Israel, as a result of this very brave policy by the Islamic Republic of Iran, has been brought to its knees. The economy is stagnating. The number of people that have had to evacuate the northern occupied territories of Palestine is incredible. Hundreds of thousands have had to leave their settlements because the resistance has made it impossible for them to stay there. You've got, of course, in Gaza itself, you've seen the Israelis being forced to reveal who they really are. You know, the emperor has no clothes now. You can see what Israel and Zionism is, whereas the Hasbara prior to that, 70 years, they built up and nurtured this image of being the victims and the ones who were actually being attacked. Everybody knows that's a lie. The American reputation lies in tatters. Israel's reputation lies in tatters. Their economies are struggling. Unemployment is rising. They've got internal strife within Israel, where people like Benny Gantz and all the others are now fighting because they know they've not achieved any of their targets. Indeed. They've not been able to destroy Hamas. They've not been able to get rid of get back the hostages, and nor have they been able to ethnically cleanse the region in the way they wanted.
Well, Master Shajar, when our guest there talks about resistance groups in the region, the U.S. has been very quick to accuse Iran for the fact that its interests are being targeted within the region. But that really is a failure of the U.S. policy because of it's the way that it is. Its presence in the region is, in many cases, even illegal when it comes to a case like Syria. But Iran's leader has praised the resistance groups for what they have done, blaming and accusing the U.S. of using Iran as a scapegoat. Is the U.S. using Iran as a scapegoat?
Absolutely, but it goes far beyond that. I think we need to get rid of the illusion that the West has got some good intention. And indeed, some of the institutions like UN, OIC, and others, all of them put together, have got a good intention, but they're not able to do anything. The fact of the matter is they weren't meant to do anything. They have been set up to be the tools of colonialism and to implement colonial powers' interests. And so really right now, the only thing which is slowing down this genocide and has actually managed to stop it being total genocide and ethnic cleansing has been the resistance. And, the resistance would not have been there if it wasn't because of the Islamic Revolution and its structure, because of ideologically and supportive. I think it's very important. Many observers, including many Jewish observers, are saying very openly and publicly that they wish that at the time of the Holocaust of Nazis, there was some country like Yemen who will stand up and defend the right of the Jewish community and trying to stop that genocide. None of the Europeans did. In reality, the level of anti-Semitism was so rife all across Europe and in the West. So really, what we need to understand is that what is Yemen is doing, what the others are doing, by doing their utmost to slow down and to stop this genocide taking place, is the only activity which is going honestly and sincerely to stop